Good morning. This is Matt Witters, editor of the Chinook Observer in Long Beach, Washington, here after deadline this morning. This is our cooperative program with KMUN and with the Daily Astorian, in which we have interesting conversations with regional newsmakers and others every Friday at this time. And with me here in the studio this morning is Terry Wilson, engineering. And our guest is Dan Ayers, who is Washington Coast Shellfish Manager for the Department of Fish and Wildlife with Washington. Thanks very much for being here, Dan.
Good morning, Matt. I'm happy to be here.
Dan's pretty familiar to many of us on the Washington side of the river. You do a great job of outreach, being down every year for an annual well-attended clam meeting in which you brief us all about what to look forward to for the coming year, and then you're often at the beach doing clam counts and one thing and another, so you're a familiar and welcome presence for us all.
Thank you. Long Beach is I often refer to as my home away from home. I love to be down on the peninsula, love to spend time down there, and it's hard to... It's hard when my boss says, hey, I need you in the office when I have a field trip planned to the Long Beach Peninsula.
Well, that's great. Well, clamming, as everybody knows, really in both counties, but particularly in Pacific County, is just such a part of the local culture and an important part of the economy, drawing, you know, tens of thousands of people to the peninsula every fall and winter and spring for clamming. You know, there are photos of people doing clam digs stretching back a century or more. It really is a big part of life there.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's true along a big chunk of the Washington coast. I grew up in Aberdeen, and I was one of those little guys who got booted out of bed, you know, at 5 mm-hmm. in the morning to go clam digging with my parents, and grew up with that as part of my personal culture. You know, my grandparents talked about getting through the Depression by hitching a ride out to the beach with friends to dig razor clams, then come back to town to trade those clams for milk or meat or other staples. So it's I know what people think about and how they how important razor clams can be, because I think I feel that way about it myself.
Well, with that long background, what do you think of the status of the razor clam population or fishery, you know, now compared to 10 years ago or 20? How are we doing?
Yeah, you look back a ways in Washington and you'll see that there's been some fairly significant ways and changes the state has made to manage the fishery, and a lot of that's due to the nature of the change of the population of our state and how much our population of the state has grown and how many more people are interested in harvesting razor clams in the days of 9 months a year. You know, much larger limits are gone, and that's partially due to the popularity of the razor clam. A lot of folks come to Washington State, and they want to be involved in the great outdoors in one way or another, and razor clams are a fairly easy way to do that without having to spend a lot of time or effort or have some, you know, unique special knowledge or a fancy boat. Mm-hmm. You just need to buy a shovel or a tube and get a friend to help you show you how to do it, and you're in business. So, mm-hmm. You know, we've changed the way we manage the fishery, but the population seems pretty darn stable. You look back in our records, and you don't see populations that are significantly larger. They're fairly stable as they were historically. So I think the way we are managing it, hopefully, will continue that as best we have control over that into the future for your kids and my kids to enjoy with their children.
Mm-hmm. Living here right on the Oregon-Washington border, it always strikes me that on a clam weekend, clam day, I see a lot of cars coming over from Oregon. Is an out-of-state presence in that fishery a notable factor in Long Beach particularly, or not?
Well, sure. Of the five beaches we manage, the largest portion of folks from out-of-state, and primarily Oregon, are on the Long Beach Peninsula just by nature of your geography there. And it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Oregonians pay a little more to dig razor clams in Washington. And, you know, I've heard stories of traffic backups. In the days before the traffic light that's on the Washington side of the Washington, the Megler Bridge there, I've heard stories of on days of a razor clam opener in Washington and on Long Beach Peninsula of traffic backups that went all the way across the bridge and into downtown Astoria. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it certainly is an indication that folks in Oregon are interested to come on over and sample some of our shellfish.
Well, that brings to mind a subject that's been interesting to me over the years, and that's the difference between the two states' approach to managing razor clams. If I understand correctly, the season is open pretty much for long swaths of time still here in Oregon as it was in Washington mm-hmm. years ago, but obviously considering that degree of interest from this side of the river and coming over there, there must be advantages in terms of what they find across the river where we manage the population differently. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I ponder that a lot too, Matt. We work fairly closely with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife staff in Astoria, the folks that are managing that fishery, and have a somewhat of an understanding of their philosophy and what they're doing. They probably could speak to it better than I can. Although I think you're right in that when you do see a lot of folks coming from the Astoria side to pay an out-of-state license fee of, 22 dollars, something like that, mm-hmm. To dig razor clams in Washington when their fishery's open and they could stay there is some sort of a testimony to either the abundance or larger clams that are found on the Washington side. Now, Oregon does have a philosophy where they manage the fishery with the thought that, as I understand it, with the thought that the major spawning portion of the population is not available for harvest, it's subtidal. And in Washington, we've taken a little different stance where we manage the fishery with the assumption that what we see is what we got, and if there's anything in the subtidal area that's bonus, and we're not counting on it for spawning stock. So we manage our fishery to a pretty specific quota on each beach each year that leaves behind, as our estimates provide, as much as 70% of the population for spawning and then also for future harvest. And Oregon doesn't, as I understand, manage to any kind of a quota. They have a season that's open 9 months a year, as I understand, 7 days a week. So when the tide's low and you have a license, you could dig a clam, or you could at least go try to dig clams. So different philosophy. I think the power of the razor clam biology is pretty evident with, there are still razor clams in Oregon, so that would show that even with that heavy harvest rate, the population can survive. But I do think that there's a higher quality of fishery in Washington, and again, as testified by all those folks that are streaming into Washington State, as a result of our more conservative management. Now, there would be some who would argue that maybe we could be a little less conservative, a little more like Oregon. And I hear from a lot of Oregon diggers who say, gee, I wish the state of Oregon would manage a little more like Washington. So someplace in between there, maybe there's a little more happy medium.
As it stands right now, flowing from that point of discussion, I think we harvest 30% of the population. Is there any movement toward upping that percentage or changing it in some way?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt. We've just finished a five-year-long growth study, and the rate of razor clam growth is pretty key in the set of calculations one needs to work through to come to a reasonable level of harvest. The rate of exploitation is the technical term. And you'd think that in the 40 years the Department of Fish and Wildlife has collected data on razor clams, we'd have a good handle on razor clam growth rates, but we really didn't. And our general observation is some of the data that had been collected a long time ago was inaccurate. So we've just completed the study. We haven't completed the analysis yet. But one of the drivers for that study was to fine-tune that number so that we could do a better job of calculating that rate of exploitation with the potential hope, at least, of increasing it to some higher value. Now, there's always the chance we'll look at it and say, ooh, 30% is too high. Although looking at the fishery, I'd be very surprised if that was the outcome. And I think there's a good chance that there'll be a higher rate of exploitation, which would mean boil right down to additional digging days and additional digging opportunities. It's not going to be 9 months out of the year, I'll guarantee you that, but it certainly could be some additional days. We had a good season. We've just finished in Long Beach, or actually all coast-wide, and at Long Beach we had offered over the course of the season 37 digging days, which may not sound like a lot, but those are good low tides. They weren't all good weather, unfortunately, but we had a really good season, and there were 106,000 digger trips on the Long Beach Peninsula made during the course of the season, about 1.4 million clams, which is the third best year in the last 15 years. So I think we're in a good spot.
Did that that rate of harvest, did we get the full 30% or something close to it? Or?
A little short this year, a little shorter than usual, and part of that was bad weather, and we certainly had a closure in January, recall, from a harmful algal bloom uptick on levels in razor clams. We had a tsunami warning. That was very unusual in my history with the department. I've been around since 1985. We've never gone through an exercise like that. Thank the Lord that it was just an exercise and nothing came of it. And the other issue that we ran into, and I think probably we'll need to talk about this at some point today, is this issue of nesting snowy plovers on the north end of Long Beach Peninsula and its impact on razor clamming. And we did take the fishery into mid-May, which is a little unusual. Typically, we don't go that late, and that is getting closer or more and more into the prime nesting period for snowy plovers. So even though we weren't quite to our TAC, we made the decision to go ahead and end it there to help minimize the impact on those birds.
Well, as long as we're on plovers, let's go ahead and talk about that issue. Let me first, though, we're coming up on about halfway through our conversation this morning, believe it or not, and let me just remind listeners that this is Matt Winters from the Chinook Observer, and we're here after deadline on KMUN talking with Dan Ayers, who is Coastal Shellfish Manager for WDFW, the Washington Fish and Wildlife Department. We are running, as many areas do, I guess, but we're running into several instances in which threatened or endangered species have some impact on various and sundry plans and seasons. And the snowy plovers are a particular case, one that I think would be at least somewhat familiar to Oregon listeners as well, having had some impact on beach access in Oregon, or potential impacts. In Washington, there is a nesting site on the pretty close to the far north end of the peninsula, which unfortunately is also, I think, where the best clam digging is. And they, as you note, apparently began to nest in sort of this area of the spring. And so there's a desire to avoid human interactions, human and pet interactions with the nest sites. With that introduction, would you like to take it and sort of discuss what the issues are?
Yeah, I'm not a plover expert, although I've learned more about snowy plovers in the last couple of years than I might otherwise have. They're a beautiful little bird. They nest in a very volatile area with a lot of wind and blowing sand and lots of predators around. And anything that disturbs them can move them off their small little nests that are built right in the sand. The nests are very hard to see. They look just like a little bunch of little seagrass, all dried up seagrass drawn together. Barely looks like a nest. And, if people get up into those snowy plover areas, or as you mentioned, pets or anything else, it can move them off those nests. And the north end of the Leadbetter, or Long Beach Peninsula up around Leadbetter, is a unique place. I mean, it's closed to driving except when razor clam digging is open. So if you're ever up there and the season's not open and there's nobody around, it almost seems like you're on the end of the world. There's hardly, except now for the big wind towers that you can see over at Grayland, there's hardly any evidence of human disturbance, anybody around when you're up there. And I do love it up there. And it's a great place for those birds to nest, although there is this impact that occurs when you get, as you mentioned, the best part of the peninsula's razor clam digging population is right in that same area, and you bring literally thousands of people and hundreds of vehicles up into that area for relatively short periods of time. I mean, fisheries only open during, in the spring and spring period only during morning hours, so folks are only up there after midnight until noon, but in reality they're only up there for the 2 or 3 hours that they might be able to dig razor clams. And so that does minimize the impact, and frankly this year we saw less impact than we have in the past. I had a chance to speak with a U.S. Fish and Wildlife bird expert yesterday at a meeting in Long Beach, and he was very encouraged by what they saw in regard to the way folks obeyed the closure signs and stayed out of those areas. There was a good cooperative effort between my agency, Washington State Parks, the Pacific County Sheriff's Department, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Enforcement officers to monitor those areas and during the razor clam dig and keep people from wandering into those areas. So at least from that report, I think we've minimized the impact and we're able to show that those two fisheries can coexist. Although I am also told that those birds do need to feed down at the low tide line, and so they're not going to do that certainly when there's a lot of razor clammers around. So going to mid-May was a great bonus, I think, for us, and I'm very happy that we got to do that. And we'll continue to work with the bird experts in the future to minimize impact as best we can to make sure that those birds at least can successfully coexist with razor clamming.
Do you think that we'll be able to have May dates in the future based on the success of these recent ones?
I'm certainly hopeful we can. I think that we demonstrated it could work this year, so I think that's a very good possibility in the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the time when the weather finally has at least some prospect of being nice, although it's certainly no guarantee, but it's great to get the kids down there when it's still a pleasant experience, not dragging them out.
I can't say, I was a little puzzled this last opener, especially on the Saturday of the opener. It was a minus 1.6 tide, one of the best tides that we'd offered all season. Mm-hmm. It was not real early. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. It was a beautiful morning, no wind, and yet the crowds were actually relatively light coastwide. I mean, we had 13,000 diggers out coastwide, and that was considerably less than the high for the season of 21,000 diggers coastwide on a Friday in March.
Mm.
That always puzzles me a little bit as we get into the spring, and the clams are as fat and beautiful condition as they ever are. People come, and I guess sometimes people just probably have their freezers full or they're busy with other activities, but it was a good weekend, and it was sure a great way to end the season.
Well, it's a funny thing on the Washington coast, isn't it? I think in a way that razor clams seem to top out at about 5.5 or 6 inches, and then I gather that sometimes they just essentially roll over and die. It's hard to tell based on what survived from one season, what will be available the next time, almost. It has been
sure.
My perception, anyway.
No, that's an accurate perception. I mean, they do have a maximal lifespan, like anything else, about 4 to 5 years, and that size is about equal to that age, although we did see a year ago, last spring, I saw the largest razor clam I've ever seen in my life that was dug off Leadbetter of 7 inches, and that's a 7-inch shell. We're talking measurements of just the shell, but that was a beautiful razor clam, and it was dug by a private citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those, their argument can be made, well, if you don't use them, you lose them, and yet they're part of the ecosystem, and are they actually lost? They're part of the food source of Dungeness crab. We know that for sure. We're managing them for human use, but we're not the only ones out there using razor clams in one form or another. So it's not a bad thing if some of those clams pass on. We do have a couple of areas that are close to harvest year-round, one at Long Beach, one at Copalis, and then one at Twin Harbors also. And we see we don't see clams get much larger than 6.5 inches in either of those, or all three of those areas. So we know that harvest isn't the driver, that they do have a maximum population size, or a maximum lifespan, and they don't last forever.
Is there any difference in the abundance between the areas that are closed and the areas where clamming is allowed? Or?
There is some, but not nearly what you would expect. Mm-hmm. And there's also not a big difference in average size. So that's an indication to us that that the level at which we're harvesting razor clams is not driving the population, which is a good thing. We don't really want to drive the population. We might be able to harvest a few more and still have that same result, and we look looking toward doing that perhaps. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's pretty amazing that inside those areas there's not a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a really interesting way of establishing what the clam population and prospects are. It almost has to be seen, at least in pictures, to be believed in a way. But could you describe what that is all about?
Sure. I mean, it's real difficult to dig a known area, specific area, with a shovel or a tube and expect to get all the clams that are there. If anybody's been out digging and see the beach after everyone's done and it looks like it's rototilled and there couldn't possibly be another clam left, mm-hmm. and you come back the next day and there's clam shows everywhere. So that's the problem we run into with stock mm-hmm. assessment. So we use a method where we pump water out of the surf and up through a series of hoses into a wand that liquefies the sand in the area of an aluminum ring that's 1/2 square meter in area. And every clam in the area of that ring floats to the surface and is counted as part of our sample. It releases from the sand not only adult-sized clams, but the little guys. So we get a good estimate not only of adult clams, but juvenile clams as well, which is an estimate we didn't have in the past in using other techniques. And it does require a fair amount of work. It requires a full day to do one transect from the full turn of the tide from the top show out to the edge of the surf. And we try to do one transect on average per mile. Those transects are randomly located along the coast. We start that work, actually started this week in Long Beach of all places, and then we'll finish by the end of August, first part of September. And having finished the entire coast, there's 56 miles of razor clam habitat in Washington, so that takes 56 transects and 56 good low tides. So that's about all you get between May and September, so mm-hmm. the guys are busy with that now.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned just in passing the closure that we had in Long Beach due to slightly above threshold levels of ASP, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those sort of constraints a little bit. ASP is amnesiac shellfish poisoning. There's also paralytic shellfish poisoning. You know, could you describe for listeners what all that's about?
Sure. Yeah, there's certainly anything that's going to interrupt a razor clam season, it's going to be a harmful algal bloom and toxins and marine toxins in shellfish tissue, razor clam tissue that will close that fishery. Three times in the last 15 years or so, there's been season-long closures, and there's no reason to believe that something like that is not ahead in our future. We do monitor pretty closely those algae levels in the surf zone. There's two primary species that are of concern. One is a diatom pseudonychia that can produce levels of domoic acid, which can, and if ingested by humans, produce this syndrome you mentioned, amnesiac shellfish poisoning, which is nothing to mess with. In high levels, it can cause death. In lower levels, it can cause permanent memory loss, and even lower levels can cause just flu-like symptoms. But the problem with pseudonychia, this diatom, is when it grows, it takes off, and it can take off quite quickly, and those levels can grow very fast, the toxin levels in razor clam tissue. ASP is fairly new to the Washington coast, and thankfully we've never seen a human case of it yet, which is good news. We know we work closely with the Washington State Department of Health to make sure that doesn't happen. PSP certainly has a longer history, more common in bays like Willapa Bay. Certainly in Puget Sound is a big issue. PSP is paralytic shellfish poisoning produced by a dinoflagellate called Alexandrium that also exists in the surf zone off the Washington coast, although until recently it was fairly rare. We've seen higher levels of Alexandrium over the last year, and it actually was a PSP issue that closed the Long Beach fishery in January for those for that one period. It didn't go up very high. It went over the action level, which triggered the closure, but it didn't really reach levels that would have been terribly dangerous, which is good news. We continue to monitor both of those. We have a program. It's called the ORHAB Project, Olympic Region Harmful Algal Bloom Project, that was started with federal funding and now has been replaced with state funding that's generated by a surcharge on shellfish and razor clam licenses that folks pay courtesy of the Washington State Legislature and some great work that was done by State Senator Jim Hargrove from Hoquiam. And that perpetuates that program. It pays for a technician that works for us, a technician that works for the University of Washington, and then the Quinault Nation up north of Grays Harbor has a technician that's funded by tribal money that cooperates with that same work. So those folks are sampling algae in the surf zone twice a week year-round, and it gives us a heads-up of what might be coming, but we're still required to send razor clam samples to the Department of Health's public health lab in Shoreline before any razor clam opener to make sure that what you're eating is going to be safe, no matter what might be or what might or might not be in the surf zone. But boy, I tell you, if we see a big disruption in this fishery in the future, short of something like what's happening down in Louisiana, God forbid, it'll be, that disruption will be caused by a harmful algal bloom. I'm confident of that.
Now, in the case of Long Beach, is there any relationship between the algal blooms and the fact that we're in the Columbia River's plume? Or is there any way to know at this point what causes these surges in poisonous algal blooms?
We could easily talk about this for another 2 hours. There's been a lot of work done by NOAA, and we have a pretty good understanding of at least where Pseudonychia, the diatom that produces domoic acid, initiates. There's two initiation sites, one down off the Hecate Bank, down off Central Oregon, and one, an even larger one, probably more dynamic one, off the mouth of the Strait of Juan de Fuca in a place called the Tully Eddy, or the Juan de Fuca Eddy. But one thing the Columbia River plume does, in reality, is they've discovered that there are times when the Columbia River plume comes out of the mouth of the river and turns right and heads up the Washington coast and actually can form a barrier. So some of these offshore blooms that we've seen coming, especially out of the Strait of Juan de Fuca, coming toward the Washington coast, and it looks real bad. And there was a case a few years ago where the NOAA scientists were up there and had seen domoic acid levels that were just off the charts and were predicting a huge impact on the Washington coast, and it didn't ever reach the Washington coast, and it was later determined that it was the fresh water in the plume that stopped it. So,
well, bless the Columbia again, huh?
Yeah, amen. I mean, the ocean's a very dynamic system. Mm-hmm. There's another study in progress that NOAA's involved with to look more closely at what happens with blooms coming out of the Hecate Bank area, but it's a very interesting topic.
We're down to our last minute, and briefly looking ahead to next season, we'll have some sort of decision, hopefully, about maybe upping the percentage of harvest. Is there anything else to be said in anticipation of the season? Is it looking good
Even the preliminary work that we've done so far at Long Beach would indicate there's a good, healthy population out there. We've got a lot more work to do. We've seen good signs of recruitment even through the winter. Razor clams typically spawn mostly in the spring, but there's a segment of the population that spawns year-round, and so we've seen some good, successful spawning already. So we're looking forward to a season. My gut tells me it's going to be at least as good as last year, if not a little better.
Great. Well,
we still got a lot of big clams around. Should be a great year.
Good deal. Thanks so much, Dan, for joining us. This is Matt Winters here on KMUN After Deadline. Dan Ayers has really been a great help to us this morning. We'll
Thanks,
see
Matt.
You again soon. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.